to Animal Companions. This is Joyce, your Radio Reading Service volunteer broadcaster, welcoming you to this edition of Animal Companions, where we read about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Today I'll be reading another chapter from The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner, and if we have some time, I'll be reading some articles and newsletters about the animals in our lives. We're going to start today's reading with The Case of the Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. In the last chapter, we learned that Perry Mason sat quietly during the hearing of Della Street. Berger tried to show how guilty Della Street was, but was interrupted by Perry Mason, who asked for a 30-minute recess. And now we'll find out if there was anything to that reason for his recess. When court reconvened, Hamilton Berger showed very plainly that he was laboring under great excitement. "If the court please," he said, "a very startling situation has developed in this case. I ask permission to withdraw the written lunk from the stand and recall Lieutenant Tragg." "No objection," Mason said. "Very well. Judge Lancashire ruled, Lieutenant Tragg will once more take the stand. You have already been sworn, Lieutenant." Tragg nodded and walked to the witness stand. Berger asked, "Have you recently made a trip to the residence of the witness, Lunk?" "Yes, sir." "That was within the last 30 minutes?" "Yes, sir." "What did you do?" "I went into the pantry and took the lid off the tin of flour." "Then what did you do?" "I reached down inside the flour." "And what did you find?" Tragg couldn't keep his voice from being nervously rapid. "I found a .38 caliber, double-action Smith & Wesson revolver." "You may tell us what you did with the reference to that revolver?" "I rushed it to the criminal laboratory to see if fingerprints could be developed. I took the number, and while I have traced that number to my satisfaction, I haven't yet secured the necessary witnesses to appear and testify. I think I can have a witness here by tomorrow morning." "Cross-examine," Berger said. Mason said urbanly, "But you have satisfied yourself, Lieutenant, as to what the sales record will show?" "I have. We have recently completed statistics so that the sales of any guns within the county over a period of 15 years can be instantly determined. That is, so far as the police are concerned. Of course, those records aren't anything we can take to court as evidence. We will have to get the original record from the dealer who made the sale." Mason said, "I understand, Lieutenant. But those records do give you, for police use, the information which is contained on the dealer's registers of firearm sales, correct?" "Yes, sir." Mason said, "I will waive all objections as to whether this is or not the best evidence and ask you if the police records don't show this revolver was purchased by Franklin B. Shore sometime prior to January 1932. Tragg's eyes showed that Mason's question caught him by surprise, but he answered after a moment, "Yes, sir. That gun, according to our records, was purchased by Franklin B. Shore in October of 1931. "And what do you deduce from all of this, Lieutenant?" Mason asked. Judge Lancashire frowned at Mason. "That question, Counselor, calls for something which could hardly be binding upon the defendant, nor, of course, would be permissible if asked by the prosecution." "I understand," Mason said, "but I take it that there is no objection from the prosecution." "Oh, none whatsoever," Berger said, with a triumphant leer at the jury. "I would like nothing better than to have Lieutenant Tragg answer the question." Judge Lancashire still hesitated, then said, "There is only one theory upon which this would be admissible as cross-examination. That would be to show the bias of the witness. In view of the fact that the question may be permissible upon the ground, since there is no objection on the part of the prosecution, I will permit it to be answered. The court cannot, of course, tell what counsel for the defense has in mind, but the court does feel that, so far as the proceedings against the defendant are concerned, the constitutional guarantee must be observed. Therefore, the court will limit the consideration which the jury may give to the answer as relating to and showing a possible bias on the part of the witness. Under the circumstances, the witness may answer the question." Tragg said, "There is no question in my mind, but when Franklin B. Shore got up after Thomas Lunk left the house, went to the pantry and concealed the gun in the can of flour, that this kitten followed him into the pantry, jumped on the floor, and that Mr. Shore pushed the kitten out and the kitten thereupon ran into the bedroom and jumped into the bed with Mr. Shore, had just vacated. I may state further that this simply goes to indicate how vitally important a witness Frank LaShore is and was, and emphasize the gravity of any attempt which might have been made to spirit him away. Mason smiled. It also indicates that Franklin Shore was very shortly after the shooting of Jerry Templar in the possession of the revolver with which the shooting was perpetrated, and of the same revolver which, in all probability, fired the fatal bullet into the body of Henry Leach, does it not? Berger said, I'm going to object to that question, Your Honor, upon the ground that it is argumentative and not proper cross-examination. Judge Lankershim said, It is highly irregular. It is far afield from the ordinary course of examination. It indicates what happens when a police witness is permitted to give his opinion and deductions under the guise of evidence. However, by failing to object to that question, the prosecution has opened the door to this entire line of cross-examination. Only, however, for the purpose of showing the bias of the witness. If this witness is once permitted to give his deductions as to what the facts indicate, counsel for the defense should be permitted to point out to the witness a possible fallacy in his reasoning. I think I see the point counsel is driving at, and I think I appreciate what his next question will be, a question which might very seriously affect the case of the prosecution. By permitting the door to be opened at all, the district attorney has given the counsel an opportunity to open it all the way. I'm going to let the witness answer the question as well as the question which I feel certain will follow. Tragg said cautiously, I don't know that it's the same gun with which the crimes were committed. It is a gun of the same caliber and the same description. There were three discharged shells in the cylinder of that gun, and the remaining three cylinders were loaded with shells and bullets of the same general character as those recovered from the body of Henry Leach, from the woodwork at the Shore House, and from Jerry Templar at the time he was operated on. Mason looked at Hamilton Berger and winked. He turned to the jury and smiled triumphantly. And now, Lieutenant, he said to the witness, I will ask you if it isn't equally fair to assume, if this weapon should prove to be the murder weapon, that Franklin Shore, having concealed that weapon in the residence of Thomas Lunk, would then have been most anxious to make his escape. Objected to, Hamilton Berger shouted, upon the ground that this is taking the witness far afield into the realm of conjecture. That is a matter which counsel can argue to the jury. It is not a question to be asked of this witness. Judge Lankershim said, It is precisely the question which I thought counsel would ask next. The objection is overruled. The witness will answer it, but remember, the answer is admissible only to show possible bias. Tragg said, I don't know. It is, of course, a possibility. Judge Lankershim turned to the jury. The jurors will understand that these last few questions have been permitted only for the purpose of showing the attitude of the witness. In other words, the possible bias of the witness, meaning by that any prejudice which he might entertain against the defendant. The questions and answers can have no evidentiary value except for that single purpose. You will consider them only for that purpose. Mason settled back in his chair and said to Lieutenant Tragg, Now, when you found the gun in the flower, Lieutenant, you were somewhat excited, were you not? Not exactly. You were in a hurry to get back to the court and hand that gun to the police laboratory. Yes. In so much of a hurry, Mason said, that I take it you didn't search the can of flour to see what else it might have contained. The expression of sudden consternation upon Tragg's face foreshadowed his answer. I didn't make any further search of the can, but I did bring the can along with me and give it to the police laboratory to search for fingerprints. Mason glanced at the judge and said, I submit, Your Honor, that the case having gone this far, the witness should be permitted to... There was a commotion in the back of the courtroom. The dour Scotchman who presided over the criminal laboratory of the police came pushing his way through the spectators who had gathered round the door. Mason said, However, Your Honor, I think that Agnes McIntosh is about to supply that information. We are perfectly willing to let Lieutenant Tragg step down and Mr. McIntosh, who has already been sworn as a witness, take the stand. Hamilton Berger said cautiously. I don't know what counsel is getting at. If the court will pardon me a moment, I would like to talk with Mr. McIntosh. Berger arose hastily and stepped over to the rail, which separated the counsel table from the spectators. He engaged in a whispered conference with Angus McIntosh, then looked at Perry Mason with a puzzled frown, following which he said abruptly to Judge Lankershim, If the court please, we would like to have a recess until tomorrow morning. Any objections? Judge Lankershim asked Perry Mason. Yes, Your Honor. If the district attorney won't put Angus McIntosh on the stand, I want to call him as a witness for the defense. Hamilton Berger said testily, The prosecution has not yet concluded its evidence. The defense will have ample opportunity to call its witnesses when the prosecution rests. Judge Lankershim said acidly, The request for continuance is denied. Proceed with your cross-examination of Lieutenant Tragg, Mr. Mason. Mason said, I have no further questions, Your Honor, nor have I any further questions of the witness Lunk, whose cross-examination was interrupted to permit Lieutenant Tragg to be once more placed on the witness stand. Hamilton Berger said quickly, Under those circumstances, I have some more questions to ask the witness Lunk on redirect examination. Judge Lankershim's voice showed his impatience. Very well. You may stand down, Lieutenant, and the witness Lunk will again take the stand. But kindly don't waste time, Mr. District Attorney. When Lunk had once more resumed his position in the witness chair, Hamilton Berger said, Mr. Lunk, did you at any time after the morning of the 13th open that can of flour in your pantry? Objected to as already answered and asked, Mason said. It has been asked and answered, but under the circumstances I will permit it to be asked again, Judge Lankershim said. The witness will answer the question. Lunk said, No, after I made the pancakes on the morning of the 13th, I didn't take the lid off the flour can again. Did you use the flour can for any other purpose than storing flour? In other words, did you keep or did you put anything other than flour in that can at any time? No, sir. Berger hesitated, then said, That is all. No questions, Mason said. Judge Lankershim looked at the clock, then at the district attorney. Call your witness. Hamilton Berger said, with somewhat poor grace, Angus McIntosh will take the stand. Mr. McIntosh has already been sworn and has testified to his position in the police laboratories. McIntosh returned to the witness stand. You were given a can of flour a few minutes ago by Lieutenant Tragg? Hamilton Berger asked. Yes, sir. What did you do with that can of flour? I wanted to photograph the can and develop latent fingerprints on it, so I dumped out the flour. What did you find? Berger asked. I found currency in bills of $50 and $100, making a total of $23,555. There was a stir of excitement in the jury box. Where are those bills now? In the police laboratory. Cross-examine? Hamilton Berger snapped. No questions, Mason retorted promptly, and then smiling at the judge said, And now, Your Honor, the defense has no objection whatsoever to consenting to the continuance which the prosecution has requested. The prosecution doesn't want it now, Berger said shortly. The prosecution rests. The defense rests, Mason said promptly. It is 4:30. I will stipulate that, so far as the defense is concerned, arguments on each side may be limited to 10 minutes. I'm not prepared to argue the case at this time or in that short time, Hamilton Berger said. The recent startling developments have been such that I would like more time to correlate the various matters which have been discovered. Then why, Judge Lankershim asked, did you object to an adjournment when the defense suggested it? Berger said nothing. Apparently, Judge Lankershim went on, you wanted to see what the evidence of the defense would be. Counsel consented to a continuance, and you rejected it. But, Your Honor, Hamilton Berger protested, I felt that I was in a position to go ahead with the case so far as the cross-examination of the defendant's witnesses were concerned, but that I was not prepared to argue the case. Judge Lankershim shook his head. Court will adjourn at 5:00. You may proceed with your argument. The court will limit the argument to 20 minutes to each side. Hamilton Berger accepted the ruling of the court, marched up to a position in front of the jurors, and said, In my view of the limitation which has been placed on the argument and the unexpected developments in this case, I am not prepared to make an extensive opening argument. I will conserve my time so as to make a longer closing argument. I will state, however, that the circumstantial evidence shows conclusively that the defendant in this case and her employer, Perry Mason, were engaged in activities which included spiriting away material witnesses. What was done with the witness Lunk is virtually uncontradicted. The defense is not on trial for that, but her willingness to spirit away a witness is shown by the manner in which she and her employer got the witness Lunk away from the police and endeavored to keep him in concealment. We are asking for a conviction of the defendant upon evidence as it now stands, regardless of what Franklin Shore may have done. I don't think any person on this jury doubts that Della Street's purpose in going to the residence of Thomas Lunk in the small hours of the morning of the 14th was to spirit Franklin Shore away. The court will instruct you that it is not necessary that the attempt be successful in order to constitute a crime under Section 136 and 136 and a half of our Penal Code. The spiriting away of a witness with the intent of preventing him from testifying at a proper legal proceeding or an investigation constitutes a crime. That, ladies and gentlemen, is the contention of the prosecution. If the defendant wishes to adopt the position that Franklin Shore had already left the premises before Della Street's arrival, it is incumbent upon the defense to assume the burden of proving that fact. I will not consume any more time now, but will reserve such time as I have left for my closing argument. Berger, glancing triumphantly at the clock and realizing that he had jockeyed Perry Mason into the position of completing his opening argument prior to the evening adjournment, leaving the prosecution in the advantage position of being able to sleep over the developments before making its closing argument, marched back to his chair and sat down. Mason slowly got to his feet, walked deliberately over to the jury box, and smiled at the puzzled jurors. He opened quietly. "The prosecution can't shift the burden of proof to the defendant until it has first proven that the defendant guilty beyond all reasonable of a doubt. I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, that Franklin Shore was not present at Lunk's residence when Della Street arrived there. The reason I have introduced no testimony is that the evidence of the prosecution proves my point conclusively. I will not comment on the evidence of the flower. I will comment only on the actions of the kitten. Someone opened the flower can. Some object was placed in that can. Perhaps the gun, perhaps the currency, perhaps both. The kitten, a playful, careless, fearless animal, attracted by the motion of the hands over the can of flour, jumped into the flour can and was promptly tossed out. The kitten thereupon ran through the partially open door into the back bedroom and jumped upon the bed. It must be perfectly obvious that the bed was then vacant, equally obvious that the kitten forthwith jumped down on the other side of the bed and went directly through the bathroom to jump on the bed in the front bedroom. Ladies and gentlemen, I will ask the prosecution, since this is a case of circumstantial evidence, to explain one thing to you. And preparatory to that, let me remind you that inasmuch as this is a case of circumstantial evidence, the law is that you must acquit the defendant unless the evidence not only indicates beyond all reasonable doubt the guilt of the defendant, but cannot be explained upon any reasonable hypothesis other than that of her guilt. Therefore, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, why did the kitten, after getting into the flower and after jumping on the bed of Franklin B. Shore, leave the bed to go into the front bedroom and curl upon the bed in there? Having relied upon circumstantial evidence, it is up to the district attorney to explain every bit of it. Therefore, in the morning, let the district attorney answer that interesting question as to the conduct of the kitten. And some of you, who are quite probably familiar with cats, their psychology, their habits, will doubtless have an answer of your own. And that, ladies and gentlemen, concludes my argument. Several of the jurors looked puzzled, but two of the feminine members were nodding and smiling as though they had already grasped the point which was causing Hamilton Berger to scowl blackly. Judge Lankershim himself seemed also to have some knowledge of kittens, for there was a smile playing upon the corners of his lips and a twinkle in his eye as he admonished the jurors not to form any opinions as to the merits of the case, not to discuss it among themselves or permit it to be discussed in their presence, and adjourned court until the next day at 10 o'clock, remarking that the defendant was on bail and would be released upon the same bail until the next morning at 10 o'clock. And next week we'll read chapter 23 to find out what happens in the next part of the trial in the case of The Careless Kitten by Earl Stanley Gardner. Kayla Cavalletto writes this article about a dog that helps other dogs who are shy. This article comes from Best Friends Animal Sanctuary. Some dogs become role models without even trying. That's certainly true for Kayak. Whether he's out on the trails negotiating for extra dog cookies or stretched out in a sunny patch of grass, the easygoing pup has a way of making nervous dogs feel like everything is going to be okay. And that can mean a world of difference for dogs who come to the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary, unsure of all the new sights, smells, people, and routines. Kayak came to the sanctuary from a shelter in need of a little extra care. He has allergies and sensitive skin, plus some trouble walking long distances. One of the ways Best Friends supports the shelters in reaching No Kill is by taking pets who may need extra care before going to homes. Kayak got the help he needed and gave back so much in return. Sunshine, sunscreen, and snacks. Kayak's love of sunshine is legendary. His allergies and pink skin make sunscreen a part of his daily routine, but caregivers found an easy way to convince Kayak that the sunscreen is worth it. All it takes is a few dog cookies to convince him it's unnecessary to be afraid, and the sunscreen actually is helpful, says caregiver Annabelle Kirk from Best Friends. But no convincing was necessary for Kayak to hop into his stroller to give his legs a break, so he could go out on adventures on the trails around the sanctuary with caregivers and volunteers. And, of course, he did enjoy all the cookies he could swindle out of whomever was pushing his stroller for that day. A stuffed animal for nervous dogs. Though Kayak may have seemed focused solely on snacks and sunbathing, he quietly became something of an emotional support dog for his fellow canines at the sanctuary. His easygoing, unbothered approach to life helped nervous dogs settle in. Annabelle jokes that because he loves to lounge, sun himself, and snuggle, it's like living with a stuffed animal for nervous dogs. He's such a great role model for shy dogs, Annabelle said. His demeanor is so neutral that he lets the shyer dogs choose their interactions with him. In a world full of unfamiliar things, Kayak offered quiet reassurance. New people? Not scary. Weird stroller rolling by? Totally normal. Sunscreen? Fine, if cookies are involved. Lady, a dog tall in stature but low in confidence, slowly grew more confident by following his lead. Walks became less intimidating with Kayak, cruising nearby in his stroller, calmly talking and taking in the world. If Kayak wasn't worried about strange sights or sounds, maybe Lady didn't need to be either. Lady also took Kayak's approach to people after watching their interactions. If they have cookies, they can't be so bad. Thanks in part to Kayak's helping paw, Lady was adopted, but Kayak didn't stop mentoring shy dogs. Emotional support duties. He continued to take more shy pooches under his wings to show them the ropes while he charmed everyone he met. Next up was Starlight, another sweet black pup who wasn't so sure about people. Starlight had done well living with other confident dogs in the past, so after Lady went home with her adoptive family, caregivers introduced Starlight and Kayak. Starlight eased right into life with Kayak, finding strength in his steady demeanor. His easygoing nature bolstered Starlight on their daily walks with caregivers and volunteers. With Kayak by her side, Starlight was ready to conquer new challenges. At the sanctuary dog park with Starlight, Kayak's priorities became immediately clear. He'd stroll in, survey the situation for approximately 3 feet, then plop himself into the nearest sunny patch for a nap while everyone else zoomed around him. This was perfect for his friends like Starlight, who needed his quiet presence to find their confidence to explore the world around them. Rolling into his next chapter. These days, Kayak continues his important work, accepting snacks, catching rays, and reminding others that the world doesn't have to be so scary. And he's now doing it in a home of his own. His adventures include a few new mentees in the form of his adoptive family's young children, and they are more than willing to join in for a snuggle session in the sun. Whether his audience has four legs or two, his message remains the same. Life is better with a little sunshine, a few snacks, and a friend by your side. This article is written by Kayla Cavalletto, and it's titled, How One Easygoing Dog Helps Shy Dogs Bloom. And it's from the Best Friends Animal Sanctuary in Kanab, Utah. Well, now at the conclusion of Animal Companions for today, I do hope you've enjoyed the readings, and I invite you back again next time when we hear more stories about the animals in our lives and how they affect us. Until then, this is Joyce for Animal Companions and for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Be well, everyone. Stay healthy. Be happy. Bye-bye.